For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, let's. We've been kind of anchoring this summer's discussions in Jesus' interactions with his disciples in John 13, where his parting words to them as they're around for this Last Supper, he says, I'm going to give you a new commandment, namely that you love each other. Of course, that's not a new commandment because it's all over the pages of the Old Testament too, but it's new in the sense that Jesus is defining it with such clarity and freshness in the light of who he is and what he's come to do. And so love, you know, doesn't just mean that we have warm feelings towards another person, that we wish them well, or that we'd like to help them along the way or something like that. But it means that we're prepared to lay down our lives to meet the pressing needs that exist in their life. And so Jesus demonstrates that as he washes his disciples' feet and as he later, the next day, goes to the cross on their behalf. And so he says, that's the kind of love that you should have for each other. Just as I have loved you, so you should love each other. Your love for one another will prove to the world that you are my disciples. And so this becomes this other important part of the package, which is that Christian spirituality, you know, really is measured by a growing capacity to effectively experience the love of God in our own lives and then be a conduit of that love in the lives of other people. And Jesus is saying here and in other places that the world looks on and they are able to draw legitimate conclusions about the truth of what you believe, the authenticity of your faith, based upon whether or not there is observable love in your life. And so this is kind of a big deal then. What does it mean, this most central thing about what does it mean to live out the Christian life? And so as the New Testament is being written, the simple command to love one another in a Christ-like way is given real substance. And that substance comes in the form of these imperatives or these commands that we find through the New Testament that are oriented around instructions about how we are to love one another. And so these one another formulas we've already talked about. Last week, Torque talked about confessing your sin to one another. That's an act of love, to let someone into your life, to have that kind of vulnerability and openness. It establishes a kind of rapport with people and intimacy with people. We talked about accepting one another and encouraging one another. These also are practical dimensions of Christian love. And tonight what we want to talk about is the really crucial issue of forgiving one another. And here, I just believe that this is one of the most important of all of these things. Paul says in Ephesians 4, verse 30, do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you along with all malice. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving each other, just as God in Christ also has forgiven you. And so this is our one another truth for tonight. Forgive one another. And I want to say just a few things about it by way of kind of getting into our topic. That I think that this issue of forgiveness is the dividing line in relationship. You know, none of us are perfect. Well, some of us are close, I suppose, but funny how none of the people in my life are that way. And I'm certainly not. And so people who, you know, I wouldn't want to be married to me, to be sure. And the people that we interact with, they're going to fail us. And we are going to fail other people. And it's how do we handle those failures on our part or on the part of the other person? Our capacity to genuinely from the heart extend forgiveness to that person. That is going to be absolutely the defining moment of that relationship. It's the fork in the road when you've been offended. And will I either go the path of bitterness and malice, slander, and all the things that he describes there, and we can have a verse 31 kind of relationship with people? Or will I go God's way and have a verse 32 kind of relationship with people, anchored in genuine forgiveness? And absolutely, this is the make it or break it issue in loving imperfect people. Also, I think it'd be appropriate to say that this is the clearest test of true spirituality. What does it mean to be in living contact with a God of grace, a God who forgives? Is it not that we are able to take that same forgiveness that God has given to us and freely extend it to other people? And we find that, in fact, that when we are bearing grudges with people, when we are making people earn our acceptance through behaviors or whatever, that here's a person that is spiritual at the most primitive possible level. That as we become more Christ-like, as the reality of Christ penetrates who we are and what we're about, that we find that we are people who are not thin-skinned, but who are able to recognize hurt when it happens and be just as quick to grant forgiveness and to restore that relationship. And so to the extent that we find that this is a real big issue for us, a problem for us, ultimately what we're seeing is that these are problems that we have with God. That God is trying to make us into a person that we're resisting. We don't want to be that way. It hurts our pride. It makes it difficult. We're vulnerable, things like that. So there's a lot at stake, it seems to me, in the area of our spirituality in terms of forgiveness. And finally, and I think this is an undisputed matter, even from the standpoint of secular psychology, that the decisive factor in emotional and psychological well-being is our capacity to forgive other people. We pay a real price. You know, you may say, I'm so pissed off with that guy, I'm not going to forgive him. And the person may not even know you're mad at him. And who's paying the price here? You are. You are. And so there's a lot of people in this world who just live a lifestyle of bitterness. And it has this incredibly coercive effect on the emotional life, on our outlook, on our ability to relate effectively to other people. It's really a drag. And so in that we all are kind of navigating through these difficult waters of how do I deal with difficult relationships? How do I deal with imperfect people, people who have hurt me, people who have wronged me? This is an important issue. In our culture, when someone offends you, what do? We just back off. We say, okay, that's the kind of guy you are, you know, then I'm just going to keep my distance. I sure don't want to get tangled up with you. And we just avoid and we move back and we are isolated and alienated. And at the end of the day, for an awful lot of people, they hit middle age, they get a little older, and they look around, all of a sudden they realize, I don't have any friends in my life at all. Why is that? This is why. This is why. Because we have not learned what does it mean to really apply the grace of God in practical ways in our relationship. That is the reason. Well, let's just break into it then and think about this. I think our natural tendency is to take offense. You know, when someone does us wrong, what are we thinking about? What's the natural response when somebody, you know, maybe they've lied to you and you found out, oh my God, they've been lying to me. What do you think? What's the first thought that enters your mind? I want them to pay. How dare they, you know, treat me like this? We want something bad to happen to them. Some people will even kind of imagine in their mind terrible things that happen to the person that they're really angry with. You may have dreams of, you know, cornering this guy in the playground and pummeling his face in or something like that for that terrible offense that he did against you. You know, I think even kids are this way. That's our natural response to being wronged. We take offense. But here is the thing that we need to realize, which is that being sinned against in a variety of ways is not the cause of bitterness. And I put that forth because we really need to think about that. The things that we do that are done to us are not the cause of our bitterness. You know, I was talking to a friend last week. We were camping in Canada, and he's reading a book that I was familiar with about a guy who went through a concentration camp at Auschwitz as a youth. Viktor Frankl is his name, and he came out of that and he really reflected deeply on his view of what humanity is made out of and why did this terrible thing happen, and he wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And his conclusion was that these people who perpetrated this horrible evil are just lost people, and that we all have the capacity to be lost in this way and to perpetrate real evils in another person's life. And there's not a hint of bitterness in this man's book. Then on the other hand, the same experience written about by Elie Wiesel, the Nobel laureate, in his book Night, is full of anger and bitterness and resentment and brokenness over exactly the same experience. What's the difference between these two men? It's not just a matter of that their psychologies are different, but the way that they put the pieces together, the way they processed their experience, and the conclusions that they came to were completely different things. You know, my point is, it's not what happens to you that creates bitterness in your heart. It is how you respond to those things. That's the real issue. You know, some people are full of great bitterness in their life for things that never even happened to them. You know, perceived slights. They thought they should have been treated one way and they weren't. They thought they were entitled to something and they didn't get it. And all of a sudden then they got this big chip on their shoulders and everybody sucks and life sucks and this is the way they are going to motor through life. And there's just a lot of people who are like this. Maybe you are one of these people. I see a nod, big nod. Yeah, it's a common problem. But I think that, see here, the important thing is, realize that this issue of bitterness is not the consequence of what happens to us, but our reaction to it. Then that opens up the door for something really good. Okay, because it's not inevitable that I become bitter by the things that happen to me in my life. That there is a measure of control I have over my internal life, and I don't have to be this way. Taking offense is a learned behavior, a habitual behavior, an attitude that's cultivated in the heart. You know, some of us we're kind of reared on this as children. I grew up in a fairly bitter household. Especially my dad was really a bitter man. And so everything that would happen around the house, it's like, you know, who did this to me? Why did you do that? You know, and this is a whole kind of crazy thing where he's just immediately assuming people are out to get him. And so the rest of us, we kind of followed along suit. We learned that that's how you react to things that don't go your way. You become angry and you become embittered by the people around you. And a lot of us have just kind of learned that that's how we orient ourselves to life. It's a learned behavior. It's a habit. And so tonight we want to look at that under a microscope a little bit. We want to think about what is this habit of sustained anger, this bitterness issue, and how do we get past that so that we can really forgive from the heart. Let's make clear that there's a difference between bitterness and anger. In the same letter, Paul says in Ephesians 4, verse 26, be angry. Be angry. There are things that happen that the appropriate response is that we are angry. And he says, and yet, do not sin. Don't let the sun go down on your anger, and don't give the devil his opportunity. So he's not saying that anger is inappropriate. You know, Jesus was angry. And Jesus said some very hostile things to people and said really tough things about them. Paul is the same thing if you read Galatians chapter 1. He's angry. But it's sustained anger. It's unresolved anger over a period of time that is what bitterness is all about. And this is what we're going to find ourselves really paying a deep price for if we continue on in it. Also, we want to make it clear that in saying that we need to turn from sustained long-term anger, to turn from bitterness, does not mean that we minimize the offenses that may have been done against us. You know, the reality is that most of us here have been wounded very deeply by people that we thought we should trust. Parents, spouses, close friends. And those wounds are very real. And betrayal in relationship is a desperately painful thing. It's the kind of thing that produces anger. But if that anger's not resolved through a process of forgiveness, bitterness will take root and will become the controlling impetus in our lives. For some people, bitterness is more or less a way of life. Maybe for some of us here this evening, bitterness, it really, in a substantial way, characterizes our emotional life, our social life, the way that we look at the world. How about this? How many of us find ourselves delighting in the failures of others that we've got issues with? We just love it when the person that has wronged us, you know, loses their job, or, you know, clearly their marriage is in the pits, and we say, ha, you deserve it, you know, you're this way. And we just subtly take real pleasure in the fact that they are suffering. It's like we conclude, ah, there's something right in the universe. The evil are suffering. You're not like that, though, probably. The person who's learned bitterness as a way of life has kept a very long list of the failures of other people. And to sit down and say, you know, what is it that really disturbs you about your spouse? Here, this person could give you a very long list. All kinds of things where she or he is really screwed up. Funny thing with people like that, you then say, so how are you screwed up in the marriage? Oh, well, it all becomes very vague at that point, you know. I'm sure I'm hard to get along with, and yeah, I can be short-tempered sometime, but clearly we don't have a clue. Because our focus is on them and their failures. And that kind of arrogance is going to destroy your marriage. It's going to destroy your close relationships. The hypercritical and dismissive person is really a person who is just driven by bitterness. They are able to see what's wrong with people with great insight, with great clarity. Oh, I know what's wrong with them, and they just lay it out. And I've been laid out by people who just, with an unusual vision, just realize how screwed up I am. And you're just like bleeding on the floor. Because they're right, and you know they're right. But the bitter person then dismisses you and walks away. They've had their advantage. They've done what they've wanted to do. They've shown you the way it really is. And now they just, we're not a part of the solution. A person driven by bitterness is going to be superficial in their relationships. They're going to be very guarded on a personal level and very defensive as well. If they perceive that you have something to say about what you see maybe in their life. And I have always thought that this dot is connected. In fact, I don't know that I've ever seen an exception to this. That people who just cannot find a way to build deeply in relationship with other people are people with profoundly unresolved anger issues in their life. And they are people who are reacting, feeling as though they should have been treated one way and they weren't. And so they're very guarded and they're hard to get into. They're hard to identify with. Very defensive. Here's a person who is basically at that place where they're, they're beyond this point of reconciliation in their relationship. They've learned that as a way of life, and now they're just no longer really interested in moving closer to people at all. The person who's learned bitterness as a way of life is into judging motives. I know why she did that. You can't fool me. I know what that's about. Judging motives? You ever judge motives? You ever think that you alone know why that person did the thing that they did? And you see all this negative, nefarious, evil, suspicious type of stuff there. Or, oh, here's the thing. I see danger coming. I know what you did. I know what you said. You failed me. So what am I going to do about that? Nothing. Nothing at all. No, everything's fine. It's great. Glad you're in my life. It's really good. As you move out into the outer darkness in the relationship, you've just withdrawn. You've shut that person down. You're not interested anymore. Or maybe you're just not wired to walk away from it that easily. And you're going to just, boom, explode in that relationship. And you're going to let them know just how angry you still are about that thing that happened today. And, oh yes, and yesterday, and the day before, and the day before, and the day before, and the day before. And that is a lifestyle of bitterness. And some of us are just, you know, so short-fused that we're just ready at any moment, because there's so much burbling under the surface, to explode in a fit of rage. So, maybe you could relate to an item or two on the list. Maybe you've got a problem in taking offense, like I do. By the way, don't you see that the people that you look at like this are so often the very ones that you increasingly become like? The people that you're bitter with are the people that you become like. And I felt like, you know, that the reality of that came crashing down in my head in a huge way as a young man. Because I had a real bitterness with my dad. And he was not a... He wasn't Mr. Supportive Dude. And so we had these tensions. And we had a very distant relationship. And it was a complicated relationship. And I, at a certain age, you know, before I was a teenager, just decided to write this guy out of the story of my life and just kind of disconnected from him relationally and emotionally. And, you know, the funny thing is that didn't really deal with the wounds that I felt from him and the anger that I felt from him. And over the course of my teenage years, I realized that I was becoming more and more just like him. You know, I looked at him as being a guy that was so uncaring that he could never move toward people. And then I realized all my friendships are just people who are experiencing a parallel universe with me. There's no real relationship there at all. I looked at him as a person who had such low regard for his family that he would be in the service of addictions rather than dealing with that problem and moving on and supporting his family. And then I realized, man, I've lost my job for that reason. And it's all the things that so offended me about this man with whom I had become bitter were me. Were me. And how... You know, that's an incredible realization at a certain point, to realize the hypocrisy deep within your own heart. But it doesn't really need to be this way. And let's turn the direction in a positive way. What does it mean to realize that the reason why Paul has to command these people to forgive one another is for all the reasons that we've discussed? It's not natural. It's not easy. How do we learn to develop a lifestyle of real forgiveness from the heart as Christ has forgiven us? Well, let's think about this. Forgive each other just as is the language, just as God in Christ has also forgiven you. And so that begs the question, you know, how has Christ forgiven us? It's all about grace. What does it mean for us to live out grace in our relationships with other people? It means that we've met the God of grace ourselves. Look what he says. This is Romans 5, verses 6 to 10. It's a great passage. While we were still helpless, he said, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. You know, one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for a good man, someone would dare to die. But God demonstrated his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Much more then, having been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from the wrath of God through him. For while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son. Much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. Man, this is a pretty important passage. What does it say? It says that the reason why we are in right standing with God has nothing to do with our goodness. Nothing to do with how hard we've tried. Nothing to do with our religion. Nothing to do with our sincerity. Nothing to do with anything. It's because God has pursued us. Because God has taken upon himself the penalty of our sin in the cross of Christ. And he's taken the issue of our moral offense against him out of the way. When? When we were helpless. When we were sinners. When we were still his enemy. That's when forgiveness was extended to us. Not when we had gotten our act together and finally gotten serious about the God thing or whatever it is. And that's the grace of God. It is possible to be reconciled with him, as it says. To have a real restored relationship with your Maker on the basis of grace, God's goodness, God's willingness to forgive you. And he's just saying, you know, just accept my forgiveness. It's out on the table. Just take it. Just accept it. Apply it to yourself. That is the heart of the Christian message. And it provides a window then into what does it look like for us to practice this kind of love in our relationships with others. God did not wait until we merited forgiveness to extend it to us. What does that mean for us then? If you can be reconciled to God, then surely others can be reconciled to you. That's what that means. Unless your standards are more exacting than God's. You know, in Matthew 18, Peter raises this question with Jesus. And if you want to read, just it starts in verse 21. Peter came to Jesus and said, "Lord, how often shall I forgive my brother who sinned against me? And how many times shall I forgive? Up to seven times," he says. I mean, that's asking a lot. I just thought I'd throw that out there as the kind of the cool disciple. I'm willing to forgive seven times. And Jesus says, I do not say to you up to seven times, but 70 times seven, 490 times. And he says, "For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. And when he had begun to settle them, one who owed him 1,000 talents was brought to him. But since he did not have the means to repay, his Lord commanded him to be sold along with his wife and children and all that he had, and repayment be made. So the slave fell to the ground and prostrated himself before him, saying, 'Have patience with me, and I will repay everything.' And the Lord of that slave felt compassion, and he released and forgave him the debt." That is the grace of God. You cannot pay God what you owe him. But God is a God of compassion. And he's saying, "I'm prepared to just cancel that debt. Just cancel it. It's done. You owe me nothing." Okay? But then it goes on. And it says in verse 28, "But the slave went out and he found a fellow slave who owed him 100 denarii, which is just a few cents. And he seized him and he began to choke him, saying, 'Pay back what you owe.' And his fellow slave fell to the ground and he began to plead with him, saying, 'Have patience with me and I will repay everything.' But he was unwilling and he threw him in prison until he could pay back what was owed. And so the fellow slaves saw what had happened, and they were deeply grieved, and they reported to their Lord all that happened. And then summoning him, the Lord said to him, 'You wicked slave, I forgave all of your debt because you pled with me. And should you not also have had mercy on your fellow slave in the same way that I had mercy on you?" What is Jesus saying? What hypocrisy it is. What hypocrisy it is to accept grace from God, forgiveness from God, and then to turn around to another person and say, "I demand that you earn my acceptance." Hypocrisy. I want to be forgiven. I want to stand under grace. But I do not want you to stand under grace in a relationship with me. You've got to earn my approval. You've got to earn my love. You've got to earn my acceptance. Can you see the internal contradiction that brings into the life of bitter people? We demand one thing for ourselves, one standard. We impose a completely different standard on others. Those are not reconcilable. And this is a part of the internal turmoil of the bitter person, that they know at the end of the day, I am a hypocrite. What I want and what I need, I'm not willing to extend to others. Could this be why you feel distant from God? Could this be why you're unable to resolve personal and relational issues with other people? Could it be that you are a bitterness waiting to happen? Could it be that you're reacting to offenses done by others, and instead of extending forgiveness to them, you've taken that aggrievement, you've taken that hurt, you've taken that resentment, and you've just put it on everybody else who has more or less the same profile? And at the end of the day, you know, you wonder, why am I so depressed all the time? Why do my relationships never seem to go anywhere? Why are they so unsatisfying? You know, one of the key reasons here is just exactly this. You are so defensive, and you are so unwilling to enter into relationships on the basis of grace, that you just, everything has to be superficial, everything has to be in your control, everything has to work out right, or you walk away. And you are a bitter person. Are there people whose forgiveness you should be seeking in your life? I'll tell you, a great way to establish closeness with another person is to realize, you know, upon reflection, in my honest moments, I've really screwed up in that relationship. And I want to go and address that person just to say, hey, you know, I've had sort of a wake-up call within my conscience. And I see these things that I've done in our relationship, and I think that's really uncool, and God has brought this to my attention, and I just want to apologize to you for these things. And maybe we need to do that. And what that does is that creates an interest in reconciliation. That creates that kind of humility, says you're an approachable person. And we, if we don't have that capacity to go to our relationships, and I just don't think that there's a single person here in this room tonight who doesn't have some people that they need to approach in just this way, to say, will you forgive me of these things? You know, and that is what brings us together, that ties us together under grace. Some of your marriages really suck, and it's because you lack the humility to seek forgiveness. And instead, you're just moving back, and you're moving back, or you're blowing up, or whatever it is you're doing. Maybe there are some people in your life who need to experience your forgiveness as well. Take the initiative. You know who they are. You know, that can be a very clarifying moment in your life as you move towards them, people who've done you wrong. And they know that they've done you wrong, and that's why, of course, they're not hanging with you. Because to be in your presence is to be guilty. And so to move toward them and just to say, you know, this relationship's not been that great, and I know this thing you are feeling guilty about, and I just want you to know, for me, it's not an issue, and I forgive you. And I love you. I want to partner in life with you. Man, if we don't have the ability to do this, we are so screwed. We just have no real tools to have a love relationship with imperfect people. Let's talk briefly then about the art of forgiving in a practical way. What does it look like? Well, the first thing is that we need to realize to forgive people, to make forgiveness a way of life, really requires a substantial amount of humility and gratitude. What do I mean by that? Humility to say, how have I also contributed to this conflict? You know, we are deeply aware and sensitive to the injustices done by others to us. But I think, again, are very not in touch with how has my attitude toward them, what about the things that I've done that have really lit them up? And just to have the humility to be able to name that and put it out on the table. I would have a hard time relating to somebody like me. You know, how about you? And to just say, you know, this is not me against you. This is not I'm better than you. It's in a relationship we together have made some real mistakes. And part of forgiving is just to have the humility to own your part of that. And to have also a certain amount of gratitude in the relationship, thankfulness, that it's not all about getting what you deserve. You know, relationships are often rooted in deep expectations, sometimes expectations that we're not all that in touch with. Until our expectation is frustrated and all of a sudden we feel distant. Right? Man, I deserve better. Man, that person, you know, definitely is not loving me the way I so richly deserve to be loved. That's entitlement. You know what happens with entitlement? 100% of the time. 100% of the time. Entitlement is frustrated. Entitlement is never met. No one will love you perfectly. God will not love you the way you think you're entitled. Never ask God, never ask another human being, give me what I deserve. Don't do that. That's a real bad idea. What do you deserve? And I mean, it's okay, funny. What do you deserve in relationship? You, as a self-absorbed, sinful, self-motivated, I'm in it for me person. What do you deserve? You deserve to be judged and written off. You do. You do. If we're going to play by the rules of justice and of entitlement, we are all losers. All of us. And so we need to be able to have at the heart of our relationship with other people, not entitlement, what do I deserve, what's just, but a gratitude that that person would even be willing to move toward you at all. Like God, for instance. Willing to move toward you, his rebel. Because he loves you. He's not overlooking who you are. He's loving you because he's set aside your offenses and he's continued to move towards you. You don't deserve it. But grace says he does it anyway. And that if that's not the bedrock of our relationships, all we're left with is power struggles and jockeying for control. And trying to extract out of that person what we think that we deserve. And we'll be miserable. Second thing I think that is a part of the art of forgiveness is to recognize that forgiveness is a decision not to punish, a decision not to withhold love. It's really not a feeling at all. It's a decision. I've added it up. I've thought it through. And I'm rendering a verdict that, yes, this person is guilty of the things that they've done, and I have chosen not to punish them, not to withhold my love, even though I may feel deeply hurt and continue to feel deeply hurt by them. And I think one of the things that has been very helpful for me in this context is to widen the lens about them to include things actually that I am thankful for about them. You know, one of the ways that we enable ourselves not to exact vengeance on the other person and to make them pay for this thing that they've done is that we're able to step back and have real gratitude in our heart for the things that are also really true about them. They're not just reducible to this offense against you, right? They're a lot more complex than that. And so I found it very important, for instance, again, just bringing up the earlier example, when I first came into touch with how profoundly hypocritical I was in relation to my own father, to begin to interact with him and to write on paper and to present to him the things about him that I loved, that I respect, things about me that I could not have had he not been in my life, however imperfectly, and to say, I thank you for that. And I think, you know, this piece of it is very positive. You know, you're not blowing smoke up a person that you're angry with. When you sit down and you calmly reflect, how has this person been such a huge vehicle of God's love in your life? And it puts into perspective the framework of who this person is. It makes it easier to make that decision not to make them pay and to not withhold your love for them, because you are seeing the significant value that really is theirs. And maybe you need to do some of that this evening in your relationships. Some of these people that you have been angry with now for weeks and months and maybe years and possibly decades, and to sit back and say, God, I thank you for the provision of that person in my life for these reasons, and to be able to present them with that. If we want to make that decision to forgive and to treat people under grace the same way that we experience grace from God, it means that we refuse to ruminate over their offense, and we refuse to gossip about them. And I worry when I hear, you know, a friend talking smack about a mutual friend. Sometimes I'm aware, you know, there's something unresolved there, and that bothers me that they keep seeing the negative. That, yeah, that's really there, but it's unbalanced, and it seems to characterize the way they view this person, and it's just so wrong. And we have to choose to move away from that, and we have to refuse to ruminate over the things that people have done to us. Let it go. Find a way to let it go. And then ultimately to realize as well that forgiveness is going to be a process. How many times should I forgive my brother should he sin against me? Peter says, 7 times? Jesus is just throwing out an arbitrarily huge number. No, 70 times 7. You're going to need to forgive today. And then when the consciousness of that offense comes before you, you're going to have to say, I forgive again and again and again and again and again. And we are always at that fork of the road, and we are always tempted to anger, we're tempted to bitterness, and God is calling on us to say, no, grace, no, mercy, no, compassion. Forgiveness. Man, if we don't have something real going with God, we are just going to allow our own corrupt nature to drive us into bitterness, and we're not going to be able to see this process through. A third piece in the art of forgiving is a desire to understand their inner workings and to move toward them. This person has wronged you. Why did they wrong you? Why did they wrong you? Okay, it doesn't excuse what they've done. I want to be clear on this point. It doesn't excuse what they've done. But if we are interested in forgiveness, it is also going to be important that we have some level of interest in understanding why it is that this person has worked out their life the way they have. What unhealed wounds or unresolved problems may be driving them in their life. Close relationships are this way. Parental relationships are often this way. And so we expect that authority figures and people close act a certain way toward us. We're deeply disappointed when they don't. We're tempted to become bitter. It's really important that we're able to stand back and say, you know, you are a frail person just as I am. What has happened to you in your life that has made you, that has brought a menu of choices before you that you've selected from and has made you the person that you are today? And I feel like, again, that this is an important part of cultivating the kind of compassion that it requires to move towards somebody, to be really interested in the whole process of genuine, heartfelt forgiveness. Why have they done these things? Can I see that other person as a deeply damaged individual, just as I perceive myself to be, and to empathize with their experience, instead of standing there judging them as though they're some sort of an alien? And finally, just our willingness to discipline in love while working at reconciliation. Here's the point. Forgiveness and trust are not the same thing. And people who fail us and people who sin against us are not people that we ought to just immediately say, oh, good, glad that's out of the way. You know, because here's a pattern of life, a real problem in this person's life, and we're setting ourselves up perhaps to be wronged again, hurt again. And to forgive doesn't mean that we just allow ourselves to be stomped on by a person. What it does mean, though, is that we're not going to punish them for the things that they have done in our life, and that we are willing to move towards them, helping them to sort out the complicated things that make up their life. We're willing to discipline them, impose consequences to them at those places that are appropriate and which are going to help them come to terms and take responsibility for the person that they have become. And we want to be all about that, not to punish, but so that we can see God beginning to do a work of restoration and healing in their life. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, this is such a huge picture of what love is. To love imperfect people requires that we understand and cultivate the art of forgiveness. And I just feel like there's just not a single person here for whom we can't say, man, I've got some work to do before God. Why don't we pray together? Lord, just thanks for this opportunity to be together, to think in concrete ways about what does it look like to extend the grace that you've given to us to other people. And I just feel like, God, this is not an easy thing for us to do. It's supernatural, not natural. And yet at the same time, just so much is at stake in terms of our own well-being, our family's well-being, our ability to be effectively used by you. And I pray, God, just that you would grant us a measure of clarity about where is it in our lives that we have drawn lines that we have stood in self-righteous judgment over others, that we have not extended forgiveness, and that as a consequence, we are basically not useful in other people's lives. Help us, God, just to come to terms with that. I thank you, Lord, that this is not just some weird power of positive thinking kind of thing, but it really is applying the love that you have given to us in the person of Christ. And I pray, too, for folks who are just kind of thinking things through here tonight and maybe have not really put together what it is that you're calling on them to do, that they would realize that what you want from them is just to say, I want forgiveness. I want what Christ has done for me on the cross. I'm prepared to just humble myself and say, I am an enemy. I am lost. And I do want to stand before God on the basis not of my goodness, but on what God has done to me, for me through Christ. I want that grace. And we just know on the authority of Scripture, Lord, that when we approach you like that, that you answer that, that you come into our lives, and that things really begin to change, and we have the capacity to have real grace relationships. So thanks for that, Lord. Help us to be a community of grace more and more as we kind of grow together. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.